So this is Roadkill Radio, of course. And again, if you have any comment you'd like to give to us, send along by email to roadkillradio@live.ca or give us a phone call at 604-525-4167. And which leads us into our last subject of the night, the idea about dependency. The new book by Vancouver lawyer, The Economic Dependency Trap, Breaking Free to Self-Reliance. We have on the line, I hope right now, or coming up in just a minute or two, Calvin Helene, who, of course, his first book was a big bestseller, Dances with Dependency, and spoke quite a bit about the Aboriginal dependency syndrome, essentially.
The fault with Canada's Indian Act is essentially this, that it classifies Aboriginal people as legal children.
Ah, yes. So, but now we have the economic dependency trap, and Mr. Helene, who's joining us now, can tell us how he's expanded his argument. Hello, Calvin Helene.
Hi, how are you?
Just great.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for coming on the show. It's Terry O'Neill here and
Ron Gray here.
Ron Gray over there. Kerry Simpson is taking the night off tonight. Calvin, we did meet quite a long time ago, so good to talk to you again, and good to see that you've got another book out. How does your what's the central thesis of the economic dependency trap? I presume that it's that it just by looking at the title of it and reading some of the promotional material and the background of your interviews you've done about the book, that you're attempting to say that there's something that's that colors our entire way of in social democracies is maybe more prevalent than many Canadians realize it is, and that we have to kind of wake up to the need to break free of dependency and embrace more self-reliance. But anyway, I'll let you talk. Tell me, am I on the right track there?
Pretty much, though I'm not attempting to say it, I'm saying it. I've got a book about it.
Okay.
And what I realized from writing my first book, which was really just focused on Indigenous people and the Aboriginal community, I recognize there are certain forms of economic dependency that are universal, and that there are principles that underline all of the forms of economic dependency, and no one has really tied all of these issues together before, I sort of stumbled upon it by writing my first book, so that's how I came upon this, and there's essentially forms of economic dependency that are throughout society,
So that's what I want to. How would an average Canadian encounter these, or how would these forms of dependency color the lives of an average Canadian?
Well, before I get to that, I can probably tell you the way that I've categorized them. There's government to citizen economic dependency, and the most common form of that kind of dependency in the Western world is, of course, welfare. And I'll have more to say about that later. But
okay.
There are, and what I learned in researching and researching and writing about all of this stuff is that there are forms of economic dependency they result in essentially the same mindset, no matter what your nationality, your culture, your language, wherever you've lived in the world, the results of economic dependency are fundamentally the same in how they manifest themselves in a mindset.
Children are economically dependent on their parents, and that's okay, right? But as we get older, we shouldn't necessarily have the same relationships as adults to our government, right? We have to grow up.
That's right. Well, there's actually a form of economic dependency that's more widespread throughout society that people have sort of recognized sort of some of the implications and impacts of, but nobody has really thought about it, and it results in what I call intra-family economic dependency. What's happened since about the mid-1990s is this is the first generation of middle class that has had either so much wealth or access to such easy credit that what we're doing is we're providing our kids with material things which we felt we were deprived of in our upbringing, or parents are living vicariously through their kids. Huh. And it results in these kids being given all kinds of stuff without ever having to do anything for it. And it's become such a problem that psychologists now call it affluenza.
Ah.
And that results in these kids having developing a huge sense of entitlement with the inability to be self-sufficient. And if you look at all of the other kinds of attributes of this kind of economic dependency, they have a this huge sense of entitlement with the inability to be self-sufficient. They develop a victim syndrome. They get into blaming and all of these kinds of things that like self-pity that are typical of people in enforced economic dependency. And they have an inability to cope, learned helplessness. Well, it turns out that that psychological profile is almost identical to somebody on welfare.
Very interesting. So that's your second type, then, the intra-family dependency.
Intra-family, and there's also government-to-government forms of dependency.
Oh, yeah, okay. Is that where we get into equalization payments?
For sure, but there's various kinds of it. I mean, I've been very methodical in how I've classified these. The first form of economic dependency is the monies that come from the federal government to Aboriginal governments. There's almost 100% dependency on federal government transfers there. There's also equalization payments. And all of this all sounds great. All of these kinds of economic dependencies sound great in theory, in that we're providing for poor provinces or poor governments and so on and so forth. But they usually have some perverse side effect. And in the case of equalization payments, there's various forms of that in federal states. In Canada, of course, it results in usually Ontario, Alberta, and BC making payments to the poorer provinces. Now, on paper, that sounds equitable and sounds like a fair thing to do,
mm-hmm.
but in practice, it has very perverse results. And one of the biggest results is that a province like Quebec, which, if it were its own country, would be considered a very wealthy country in the world, received about 8.6 of the 14.8 or something like that transfer payments last year. And it's resulted in Quebec having a social or a pension system where people retire at 60, and people in Alberta, BC, and Ontario can't retire until they're 65.
Right, and also a lot of that money, I think I raised this with one of our guests last week, coincidentally, a lot of that money ends up going to support cultural programs and the arts and things that sort of give French Canadians a strong sense of their national identity, and I think it's a perverse or a misconstrued sense that somehow they think that they've got this huge, great cultural institutions that sort of flow naturally from their society. It was Mr. Galganov that we talked about last week.
Oh, yes, Howard Galganov, yes.
That really is just propped up by transfer payments from the rest of the country, and then if they're left on their own, maybe they wouldn't be feeling so like they're such a unique culture. Maybe they would be forced to have better relationships with the rest of Canada and the rest of the world. Anyway, that's sort of a sidebar. But
it is a sidebar. And the funny thing about it is if Quebec people understood one of the first principles of economic dependency. I've called these principles, I've invented a new word, I've called it undependence, which is a verb for all the teachers out there, which means going from being economically dependent to economic independence. And one of the fundamental principles is that the more dependent you are, the less on any person or any entity for your sustenance, the less control you have over your destiny. The more Quebec has its hand out to Canada, the greater their economic dependence. It's a funny thing, and
that's
I pointed
ironic.
This out in the book.
Yeah.
And but the other side effect that it has is it prevents governments from developing forms of self-reliance and essentially growing up as a government in a way that would really ensure its economic independence. Another major form of government-to-government dependency is aid. It's systemic aid I'm talking about particularly. And for example, Africa. In the last 50 years, Africa and other nations have received over, I think it's $1 trillion in the last 50 years. And by almost every economic and social indicator, things have gotten worse in almost every African country, with a few exceptions. Now, you talk to some people out there, and they say, well, it would be really bad if we didn't have these transfers. On the other hand, what these transfers do is, according to Africans themselves, who are, many of them are shouting at the top of their lungs, and they're not right-wing people, they're ordinary people or economists that have thought through the matter. They're asking for this aid to stop, because what it does is it results in those governments not taking the kinds of developmental reforms that they need to take to be self-sufficient. So rather than, and on top of that, that aid money results in corruption. It displaces a lot of the natural entrepreneurship that otherwise might result. And so these things have to be looked at very carefully.
Yeah. Mr. Helene, a little earlier in the program, we were talking with another guest about the Canadian Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, and the fact that one of its deficiencies is that it does not include the right to own private property. I'd like to hear from you what your evaluation is of the role of private property in independence, and in particular the fact that for Canada's First Nations and other Aboriginal peoples, property is either held for them by the Crown or held for them by a banned government, but the right of individuals to hold property and to use it, as Hernando de Soto suggests, as a lever to for entrepreneurship, is denied to them. Does that enter into this in your mind?
As a matter of fact, I've written a chapter in my new book on it, and private property ownership is critical. It's critical because for the same reason that it was critical for the U.S. Most people don't know that when the U.S. was 13 colonies, on the East Coast, they held their land in common, and people starved. Mm. They could not generate enough agricultural output off the lands that they held in common, and the problem was nobody owned it.
Mm. So nobody would take real responsibility for it.
Well, you have a different mindset when you don't own something, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. That was the tragedy of the commons. I just want to remind our listeners, the title of your new book, which has just came out last month, I think, is The Economic Dependency Trap.
Yeah.
And if they want to look it up at their local bookstore, the name Helene is spelled H-E-L-I-N. Sorry, I just wanted to get that in before we
on. Yeah, now, Calvin, you were talking about the four different types of dependencies: government to citizen, interfamily, government to government. And what's your fourth type?
The fourth type is intra-organizational. It could occur in any kind of organization, like corporation or a nonprofit corporation. And one of the examples that I cited in my my book was the distortion created and this was right from the discussions of churches online when they set up missions where the missions become dependent on the Western church that's setting them up. And there are a whole variety of complaints about how that creates problems. And in corporations, economic dependencies created within the organizations where, for example, you have one group that is the one division of a corporation that's selling, you know, is responsible for marketing whatever products are being marketed, and another that is doing the research. Well, the one doing the research is completely dependent on the marketing arm, and I guess that's okay. But there are forms of distortions that occur within the corporations. Oh, another form of economic dependency I classified as government to citizen that I in my book is the form relating to corporate essentially corporate welfare.
Right.
And welfare doesn't just come to people, it also flows to corporations. And the sight of these corporations in the U.S. who are, quote-unquote, too big to fail, queuing up for their handouts was just unbelievable. In China, they call the Chinese system socialism with Chinese characteristics, and I think I jokingly heard one of the Chinese leaders referring to American capitalism is socialism with American characteristics.
That's true. Yeah. Well, that's what I found kind of too rich, I think, in the Tea Party uprisings of the last year in the United States was specifically with the health care that they had passed there. And a lot of the Tea Party is saying, we can't have this. This is socialism. And I think, you know, folks, you've got socialism in a very big way in the United States already with all your entitlement programs. Why does this suddenly make it socialism and not the everything else that you have in place?
Yeah, well, the irony in the the corporate bigwigs from the big car companies flying on their private jets to to Washington D.C. for their handouts is crazy, and one of the incidents I cited was Lehman Brothers, which collapsed. But in the days before its collapse, one of their vice presidents was flying from his home by helicopter every day and drawing huge salaries. I mean, the excess and the craziness of all of that. But I think it's you could get lost in the detail, but I think what is important to understand is that people think that because we're all different, you know, there's different expressions of this and that. But when you look at the results and the mindsets that are created, or the mindset that is created from putting people into enforced economic dependency, if you consider the fact that you know, it's only supposedly 300,000 to 400,000 years that we've evolved as a species from Homo erectus, which is a very primitive kind of monkey, to Homo sapiens. It's not surprising that when you put people into a similar situation of enforced dependency, whether that person be a First Nations person from Canada, an inner-city African-American or Latino, or what they're calling the white, growing white underclass in North America, or whether that person is a former East German, they will all start to think and develop the same kind of response to it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the more I listen to you talking about the distortions that are caused by the by these manifestations of dependency, whether government to government, into family, government to citizen, government to business, or interorganizational, the more I think of this as like a disease, or and then I start thinking, no, it's not a disease. It's like an addiction, like a drug addiction. And then suddenly I got this understanding of the hysterical reactions that we saw in Europe in the last couple of months in Greece and then more recently in France, to the minor changes in their welfare systems there and their pension systems, it was almost like they were getting there. It was a drug addict having his drug yanked away from him.
Well, you know, the situation of the Greeks was totally absurd. I mean, here they are rioting because they feel entitled to their entitlements. And, you know,
which they cannot afford.
Yeah.
Which they cannot afford, and they're not prepared to do any of the work to pay for it, which is why the Germans, I mean, that's another form of equalization, right,
in
their
is.
System.
Yeah.
I mean, the Germans, who are very disciplined and very hardworking, said, wait a minute, why would we help to bail out a system where 20% of your population is paying tax, and you get to retire at 58 when we all have to work our asses off until we're 65. That is causing serious problems. And you know, it's no wonder when people from third world countries come to a Western country, they think they've reached the land of milk and honey because people just give you stuff. And you know, of the 7 billion people on the planet, it's amazing that some people have developed the attitude that they're entitled to lifelong cradle-to-grave sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start to examine this and where this came from, what I've done in this book is looked at the U.S. And in the U.S., what originally made the U.S. a powerful nation and itself completely economically independent was the fact that after the First World War, they paid for their entire war effort through their own Liberty Bonds, so they didn't owe anybody a cent. Second World War, they paid for their whole war effort through Liberty Bonds and taxes. And at the end of that war, they were in a position of producing 60 to 70% of the world manufacturing output. Up until about 10 years ago, or maybe a little bit further back, they completely owned and controlled the world economy.
Yeah.
In a very short time period of this generation of me, we have to have it right now, right here, they've given away the keys to the economic kingdom. Remember when only a year or so ago the Americans were criticizing the Chinese human rights record and this and that? Well, you don't hear that anymore, do you?
No, you don't.
And
why is that?
Because Timothy Geithner has to sell treasury bills to the Chinese.
For the first principle of economic dependency, or the most fundamental one I mentioned. The greater your reliance on someone or some other entity for your sustenance, the less control you have over your destiny.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Haleem.
And guess who's making the criticisms of the U.S.'s QE2 budget and everything else, the Chinese.
Yeah. The title of your new book, The Economic Dependency Trap, made me think of a fact that emerged during the Tea Party movement in the recent election in the United States, that now more than 51% of the households in the United States are in receipt of some kind of government stipend. That's an it really makes it look as though one of the ways in which government consolidates its control over people is to make them economically dependent on those on that government.
Well, for sure. I mean, that was a technique of government and of colonization. The reason why Native Americans are reliant on government is because that was a specific policy of government. When the Plains Indians would not stop chasing the buffalo and come onto reservations, the cavalry were ordered by the U.S. government to wipe out the buffalo herds. They did that in about 10 years, so that they were successful in putting then the Native Americans on reserves. In Canada, in northern Canada, we had the RCMP kill the sled dogs of the Inuit hunters. The problem that we have now, though, is that this is a much different time, and for the reasons I pointed out in my first book, Dances with Dependency, we now need those young Aboriginal people that are depending on welfare or various social programs. We need them to be gainfully employed and participants in the Canadian economy because of what I call a demographic tsunami.
Oh, exactly. Oh, they're a great untapped resource, and they have an expanding population that is more than
which the rest of Canadians do not.
Yeah, yeah. It should be the envy of all of the Canadian groups.
But it depends on how you approach it. Like, Canada cannot replace its skilled workers with immigration alone. The cost is quite high for an immigrant.
Yeah.
The monies are much better spent in solving this problem. And for the first time in 2007, the Center for the Study of Living Standards basically came up with a guesstimate or a projection of what the value to Canada would be if Aboriginal people were educated to the same level of other Canadians and received income parity. And their best case scenario cumulative until 2026 was that Aboriginal people could be contributing over $400 billion to the GDP of Canada.
Hmm.
Now that's a pretty big figure for a small country, but I think the real opportunity for wealth creation is with the resources that Aboriginal people control. Most people don't realize that of the 22 treaties that are already signed in northern Canada, those major northern ones,
yeah,
the Aboriginal population controls over half the Canadian landmass. We're still a natural resources economy. We still are, as mm-hmm. they say, hewers of wood and drawers of water to a large extent. And to the envy of the world, of course, in this kind of international economy. But what can you imagine the kind of wealth that could be created if Aboriginal people were brought into the economy in a way that was constructive and met everybody's environmental requirements and so on and so mm-hmm. forth? I think there's a huge opportunity there. On the other hand, If we don't deal with this issue, what we're facing what I call a demographic tsunami. In 2006, the transfer payments to First Nations communities was about $10 billion, and there's about another $10 billion in transfers or services from the provinces and territories. So for 650,000 Indian and Inuit, it was about $20 billion. Most people don't realize that the Métis population, by their estimates there's over a million of them, are the only mixed-blood population in the world who have their rights entrenched into the national constitution. They're using that fact to win court cases at the Supreme Court of Canada establishing Métis rights as Aboriginal rights. So they say they're going to use those wins to get the same level of government programming. So what the demographic tsunami is are we now talking $40 billion in social welfare spending at a time when a third of our population is getting set to retire, and those people will not be paying into the tax coffers of the country, and they themselves will be reliant on very expensive social welfare programs like health care.
Wow.
You know, the train is coming down the tunnel, and will it run over us, or is it a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, there's a new movie out now about a runaway freight train, and
Unstoppable.
Is this unstoppable? What does it take turn this around? Are there some remedies that you've identified in your book, The Economic Dependency Trap?
Well, that's why I'm writing these books. If people would ask me how I would economically classify myself, you know, there's all of these artificial ideas that people have about categories. And, you know, am I left wing, am I right wing, what am I? Well, I don't regard myself as any wing. I regard myself as having common sense. The common sense that was practiced by our grandparents. Before I answer your question, I want to just, if you don't mind, talk about how this situation came about.
Oh, sure, go ahead. Yeah. Yes, yeah, we have plenty of time.
Prior to the Great Depression, every country and every society in the world cherished the idea of self-reliance because the alternative was you would starve and die. And when the first form of relief was introduced by the Americans in 1935, FDR in his State of the Union address made a speech, or State of the Union address, yeah, and sorry, I've been traveling all day, so
that's
I've
okay.
been I'm a little bit out of it here. But what he said was he summarized the ideas that were common to probably our grandparents. And what he said, in giving out this kind of relief, he said, we have to be careful it does not destroy our national fiber, that it, this could be like a narcotic that destroys people's spirits. And he went on and on, and it's a very interesting speech. But I think it was indicative of the fact that people really highly regarded this idea of self-reliance.
Well, can I stop you there? I just add a little more historical background. And I spent 3 days at a by invitation seminar put on by a group called the, I think it was the Liberty Institute in the United States, where the whole focus of the discussion was institutional versus private charity. And I did a lot of reading in advance of this so I could have an informed opinion around some of these tables. And I was really struck by this, I'm talking now in the 19th century, a lot of the private or church-run or men's or women's charity groups or community groups that offered relief to widows and to orphans or to people who are in emergency. And their number one concern was that they didn't encourage something they called pauperism. Pauper. Now, we hear the term pauper, but this whole idea of pauperism we don't hear anymore, but this is exactly what Roosevelt was talking about. Somebody who becomes by nature caught in what you call the economic dependency trap, a professional pauper. The idea of pauperism being an anathema was very strong in the 19th century. And
well, the idea that they had was that society was like a bank. And that you were only supposed to take out whatever you put into it, and their concern was that this could lead to both the financial and moral bankruptcy of the nation, right, or mm-hmm. of nations, it's a really important concern, and I'll get to that in talking about why welfare doesn't work.
Okay.
But what happened was we as a society, and I only just started to think about this because of my first book that I wrote about Aboriginal people, but, you know, everyone is quick to identify the Aboriginal population, but our entire society has swung from one that cherished self-reliance in that time to one that's become very government-reliant. The amount of spending on government social safety net, or what some people sort of tongue-in-cheek call the social safety hammock, it's become so ridiculous, is cause for a whole variety of reasons of concern. The first issue that I think there is with it, and that idea that the government should provide more and more for its population, grew out of the late 50s and early 60s when we had this huge baby boom workforce that was coming on stream, mm-hmm. and the idea was that we could keep growing our economies. You know, the Great Recession of 2008 has sort of caused people to rethink or reevaluate whether that actually can happen. In a world where there are finite resources and where there is a lot of competition coming on stream like China and India.
Yeah.
And anyways, the idea was that we could keep the population could be provided more and more sustenance from the government, and then that people didn't have to be self-responsible grew to a point where I think in some ways in a fairly absurd situation. And I want to qualify what I'm saying is most people think I'm completely anti-welfare, but I'm not. And I'll explain why I'm not and where I think it's appropriate. But So the pendulum has swung, and now we're in a situation where people, we've conditioned huge segments of our population to expect anytime anything goes wrong, the government to bail them out. And the problem with that in the first place is that the greatest thing that we have as social animals is the social skills and networks that we originally inherited from thousands of years of social evolution, where we learned to support each other in a healthy way through our families, through our communities, and if you're an Aboriginal person, through your tribes. You cooperated and worked together. And so when you put all your eggs in the government basket, you wipe all of those important community and social and family connections and skills out. And what do you do when the government goes broke? You know, and it may sound ridiculous to say that, but consider the fact that the U.S. has a combined federal, state, and municipal debt estimated to be 130 trillion plus.
And that's substantial for every man, woman, and child in the United States. That's
it's close to $1 million.
Calvin and Terry, I remember during the late 60s, I worked for the Canadian government down in the United States. I was attached to the consulate at Cleveland, Ohio. And being part of the diplomatic circuit, I managed to rub elbows with a lot of people, both state and federal. And there was a guy, one of the Beltway movers and shakers from Washington. His name was Cloyd Schlager. And I remember him saying to me in 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was just bringing in his war on poverty, which eventually turned out to be the thing that destroyed the inner city family, because the federal government became a better husband and father than most inner city men were able to be. Anyway,
yep.
Cloyd
Just to your point, back then, there was 25% of African American children were born out of wedlock. Now we're at 70%.
Well, Cloyd said to me, "Ron, get into poverty. That's where the big money's going to be." That quote has stuck in my mind since 1966.
Now, in The Graduate, the P word was plastics, but in real life, the P word is poverty.
Poverty. Okay. Get into the poverty industry. That's where the real money is.
Yeah, a good anecdote, Ron. Very good. Yeah.
Well, and there is a poverty industry out there.
There sure is.
They're not interested in hearing real solutions. In fact, I was just a member.
They would regard undependency as a four-letter word.
For sure. I was appointed recently as a director of the National Council for Welfare. And my first effort to make a difference while I was on that council was to change its name to the National Council for Self-Reliance or Self-Sufficiency. And my view is that welfare policy should have as its objective to enable or to incentivize people to be self-reliant. And it shouldn't be a system that rewards dependency and enables dysfunction and discourages self-responsibility and personal accountability.
Very good point. In all of this, you've talked several times, you've mentioned the word, the moral problem with this, or the moral hazard. I don't think you've actually said that. But there really is we're not just talking here about economic, whether you're wealthy, whether you're poor, but we're also talking about something, lack of a better word, that happens to, that's corrosive to your soul almost when you become...
I'll tell you why that is.
Yeah, tell me, please.
I heard there's a line in the Quebecois songwriter Felix Leclerc's song that goes, "The best way to kill a man is to pay him for doing nothing." And when I heard that and first read that, it made sense to me.
Yeah.
It made common sense to me, but I didn't understand why. And then I started thinking about what my grandmother used to say to me when I was a kid, and I would be moping around the house, and she'd kick me outside and say, if you want to feel better about yourself, go out and do something useful, and you'll feel better about yourself. And then when you're a kid, you just think you're getting turfed outside. But in retrospect, what she was saying was something that was very profound. The William James, the eminent American psychologist, said one of the deepest principles of human nature is the craving to feel valued by your close social relations.
Mm. Yes.
When I give you a welfare check, what I'm giving you is your ability to survive materially, but what I cannot give you, which can only come from working for what you get, is the psychological payoff and the validation of your sense of self-worth that you get when you you work for a living. So you can, so your family then recognizes, not a word has to be said, but they recognize that their meal came from you.
Mm-hmm.
When you have an artificial form of sustenance, it's obvious that that you're not responsible for it, so you cannot get that sense of self-worth out of it. It's a really, really important principle that really relates to human nature.
I think you could apply that equally to multi-millionaire celebrities whose lives are so often such a ruin because deep down inside they know that just being famous for being famous does not satisfy your craving for real significance.
Or as one online blogger said, do we need any more worthless hedonists like Paris Hilton who are famous just for being famous?
Yeah.
This is a point. I mean, another form of economic, intra-family economic dependency is the dependency created in wealthy families by not giving the monies with any sense of what to do about it. And it's the reason why most of the wealthiest people in the world, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, these types, they've thought through this matter very carefully. Money without receiving monies without having to do anything for it can destroy your family. It can destroy a country, and it's the reason that I came up with a principle which I learned from Warren Buffett. Another principle of undependency is the greater wealth you have, the principle is the greater discipline you have to have in how you spend it.
Hmm.
Because we've talked about affluenza, which is allowing middle class people to turn their kids into these people with a huge entitlement mindset, and how that can impact a family. Well, imagine if you were the recipient of $1 billion, and there's one of the things I cited was an article about a family from, I think they were from Minnesota, where there are four generations of family that where no one has ever been gainfully employed, and all kinds of problems. I mean, you know, the difference between the social problems with rich and poor people is rich people can afford to pay for fancy lawyers and to hide it.
Better treatment too.
Yes, and so it's an issue that's really a fundamental issue of human nature, this system is not sustainable. First of all, because why would you want? It doesn't work in the first place. Why would you want to lock identifiable populations into intergenerational poverty when we know it doesn't work? And even if it did work, when you start looking at the demographics and the financial situation that exists in the West for almost every country, it's not sustainable. We cannot continue to have this kind of social welfare system. I mean, if you wanted to take a quick snapshot of the U.S., by 2020, the white population will have grown by 1%, Native American by 26%, the Hispanic are the African American by 36% and the Hispanic by 77%. So you've got your biggest growth in the population that is the lowest educated and now the biggest user of social welfare programs right now. At the same time, you've got a third of your mainstream population, like Canada, getting set to retire. There were 16 workers per every retiree in the 50s and the 60s in the U.S. By the time that baby boomer cohort retires, you're going to have 2-to-1. Who's going to pay for these social welfare programs?
Yeah, that's an open-ended question that nobody is really answering. And,
well, Mr. Helene, you asked earlier, why would you lock an identifiable group of people into multi-generational dependency? I can only think of two answers. One of them would be racism, and I honestly think, well, some of that still does exist. I think that that's largely a holdover from our past, that most of us have begun to get over that. The only other answer would be stupidity. And I think, you know, when I look back at the war on poverty and Trudeau's good society and all of the primarily liberal government programs that have tried to subsidize identifiable groups in order to lock them into political support, without thinking through the results of it, I think stupidity is the word that classifies it.
Well, a more charitable view would be that it's resulted from a time when our economies looked like they were going to grow forever, and we had no idea what the consequences of these kinds of programs would be. Well, now we have a pretty good idea.
Yep. Yeah. Calvin, we're going to have to stop it now. It's calvinhelene.com is your website. Your book is The Economic Dependency Trap, Breaking Free to Self-Reliance. Calvin Helene, you're an author, a lawyer, an entrepreneur, a philanthropist, a community activist. I wish you the best luck and good fortune with the success of your book and all of the projects you're involved in. You've been a great guest. This is an important book, and I urge all of our listeners and viewers out there to pick it up, take a look at it at least, and talk about these ideas and make sure that politicians know about them as well, and try to get some reforms needed reforms in place while there is still time.
I'm going to be on the email tomorrow to a lot of my friends, telling them to listen to the archive program of this broadcast and telling them to get your book. Yeah. Thank you so much for opening a lot of really important dimensions of a problem that is facing each and every one of us.
Thanks, Calvin.
You're very welcome, and I would just want to mention one thing to your listeners. If they want to see the coolest 3D book trailer ever, Google Economic Dependency Trap and YouTube, and you will see a really neat high-definition trailer on this book that was created by somebody that just likes what I'm doing.
Excellent.
Right after we go off air, okay, I'm going to bring it up.
Thanks very much, and good night.
All right.
Thanks for joining
us
tonight.
Good night, Calvin Klein.
Yep, good night.
Calvin Helene, thank you. A great guest and tremendous quite a guy, very energetic and very thoughtful, and you know, he doesn't have to write these books. I mean, he's got a very successful life.
He's successful as an entrepreneur,
as a lawyer. But you know, obviously, this is stuff he really believes in. Interestingly enough, he made up an expression. I forget what it was earlier. He talked about it. I wrote a column today for the Tri-City News. It's going to be published on Friday, and I made up an expression. You've all heard of the expression NIMBY, right? Not in
yes,
my backyard.
Not in my backyard.
Well, there's something else coming up that I thought was sort of intergovernmental. If one municipality has it, the other one wants it. If one neighborhood has it, the other neighborhood has it. And I called it the Ithiwititis, and Ithiwit. Ithiwit. If they have it, we want it too. So, Ithiwit. Ithiwititis. So, you know, I'm thinking that actually works in very nicely to this dependency trap, because that's part of this too. It's a mean kind of a, well, not in all instances. They talk about fairness and they talk about equity and if, you know, we just want to be fair, but really.
It's a violation of the 10th commandment.
Well, no, yeah, coveting.
Yes, that's right.
And nobody talks about affordability, and sustainability, you know. And the same goes true for all of these entitlement programs.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about that stuff either. So, very good. You know, it's not just, obviously this book is not just an economic book, but it's a book about, it's a morality book as well. It's a morality tale.
We are going to have to change our minds. Metanoia.
Yeah, that's right.
Metanoia.
Good stuff. That's been Roadkill Radio, another great show tonight. Thanks, Ron. And that's for Ron Gray and Terry. I'm Terry O'Neill, and we're saying good night. We'll see you again.
Good night, everyone.
We'll see you again next week. You've been listening to Roadkill Radio.